Lord William Thompson Kelvin was one of the exalted leaders of the Western scientific world during the latter years of the 19th century. One writer referred to him as the Carl Sagan of the gay 90s. Lord Kelvin's contributions to the realm of physics were substantial, particularly in thermodynamics and the science of navigation. He saw so much discovered and accomplished in his lifetime, so much so that toward the end of the century, he was moved to pontificate that physics was now at last a largely completed science, he said. All that is left is to gather up a few loose ends here and there. It was a promising comment for students of physics, but alas, it was a tad premature. For over the next 30 years, physicists went on to discover such things as X-rays and the theory of relativity and the whole realm of quantum physics. So within just a few decades of all the classic dogmas of Lord Kelvin's physics have been knocked into a cocked hat. Writing some years later about this remarkable chain of events, Dr. Lewis Thomas said something important not only for physicists, but for anyone working in almost any field. He said, "We need to pay more attention to our own ignorance. A good education ought to include the news, among other things, that we don't understand a flea, much less the making of a thought." Thomas then went on to lay out a whole assortment of mysteries about which the scientific community didn't have a clue. And he argued further that we ought to think of science as the endless pursuit of mystery. Now, Thomas was addressing the scientific community, but he might as well have been talking to any of us, and particularly to the church in our day, for we too are called to the unending pursuit of mystery. In our case, the mystery of God's redemptive love in human life, and yet we find ourselves surrounded by the forces of reductionism, which seek to destroy or deplete that mystery all the time. I don't need to tell you that there are churches all across this land filled with people who believe they already know everything they need to know about the nature of God, about Jesus Christ, about the church, and about human nature. There is among those people, many people, a temptation to forget the central mystery around which we gather, which is the mystery of God's ever-expansive love, which no human can ever adequately define. We need reminders of our own limitations, of the danger of moral and spiritual pride, which can result from thinking that we have it all figured out. In part, at least, such pride was at the heart of the divisions that racked the church in Corinth, to whom Paul wrote those words that Mark read for us just a few moments ago. The Corinthian church had been beset by cliques and clashes, by all manner of factions, each claiming to have a superior way and understanding. Each faction had a different leader, Paul, Cephas, Apollos. Each faction was highly egocentric, and each thought it had discovered the way to be Christian in that time, that it had the answers, as it were, that its understanding tied the faith together tightly with little room for loose ends. To that fragmented congregation, Paul wrote, seeking to counter that prevailing wisdom. He invited the Corinthians to consider the humble circumstances in which they had been called. When they were brought into the community, he reminded them not many of them were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Few were nobly born. And yet now, amid their divisiveness, they each seemed to be claiming superiority over the others. Paul reminded them that God had chosen to shame the wisdom of the world by means of the folly of the cross. and he called them again to lives of cross-centered discipleship. This was no anti-intellectual appeal. Paul told them that Christ had become their wisdom. Theirs was a wisdom of the cross, a wisdom of humility and vulnerability. And that is a mystery. When we, in our day, think we have reached a point of superior understanding, when we believe that our limited perspectives reflect final truth, when we find ourselves willing and ready to judge who the real Christians are and to hell with the rest, then it is that we need this corrective word from Paul. And it is, I believe, a word entirely appropriate for this Reformation Sunday, when we celebrate the heritage we derive from a 16th century German monk who looked around him at a church that had stopped searching out mystery, which seemed comfortable with its claim of ultimate truth and ultimate authority, which seemed to say that faith was a largely completed matter. As I said in First Matters this week, we look to Martin Luther, who said no, that the faith was ever more expansive than that, and who launched a life-restoring revolution in the church 502 years ago this week. Since then, saints in every generation who were open to further exploration of the mysteries of God's grace have launched subsequent reformations. Today, we are beneficiaries of their courage and insight, and of a Reformed tradition molded by its motto, Ecclesia Reformanda, Semper Reformata, Semper Reformanda, the Church Reformed, always reforming, which I would paraphrase for our time to mean always in need of reformation. We need to remember the Reformation in our time, because there are so many in our churches and culture today who are no longer persuaded by such a motto, who live their lives in the pursuit of the firm technical certitude of our age, and who thus turn the Bible into a collection of moral absolutes with no room for mystery. Fundamentalists have tried to confine God within several tightly construed affirmations, and others from different directions have made similarly rigid pronouncements about human behavior and thinking, ironically in the name of liberal thought. The power of the word is lost, lost for such folks because of their prior agenda. Mystery and wonder are lost, for such camps allow little room for questions or variant understandings, little room for reformation. But God, says the Apostle Paul, has chosen to destroy the wisdom of the wise and the righteousness of the self-righteous, has replaced them with the wisdom and righteousness of Christ and his cross. Can any one of us claim to have some final word on why God chose weakness rather than power as the vehicle of reconciling the world to God's own self? Or why God chooses a sometimes faithful, sometimes unfaithful minority of the earth's people to be bearers of God's good news? Can any of us claim to understand why God has regularly, systematically undermined all the attempts of those who have sought to build fences around the church, and instead has cast the net of divine love ever wider, generation after generation? You can't reduce such mysteries to a few fundamental principles and then claim to have a lock on Christian wisdom and understanding. The Christian faith is dynamic, not static. It is life, not principles. It is lived out in an open table fellowship, not a gated community. To be a Christian is to be a person in touch with mystery, to be aware of the limits of our understanding. It's not to say we shouldn't explore those limits as far as we can. life of the mind and the service of God is a long-standing Reformed keystone. But we'll discover that some of those explorations, rather than leading to greater clarity and certainty, will only deliver us more deeply into the mystery. Mysteries should engage our minds, not idle them. There will be times always when the only appropriate response will be sheer wonder and awe. Christian faith is anchored in a deep mystery, the mystery of God's relationship with humankind. Not a mystery like a puzzle to be put together, a code to be broken, or a detective story which discloses the culprit on the final page. This mystery stands at the beginning and the end of all Christian thought. It represents the limit, the final reaches of human wisdom and reason. But in such limitation is grace, for it delivers us from all the impulses we may have to play God. It frees us to be fully human and explore the mystery. If we would honor the Reformation we celebrate this day, it will not be by pious pronouncements or by arrogant spiritual pride. It will be by commitment to the pursuit of mystery and wonder and awe, including the mystery of the power of God to transform human lives. Do you know the story of Derek Black? Derek Black grew up in a world few of us in this room today can comprehend. He was the child of two white supremacists, and at an early age, he became something of a celebrity and a rising star on the circuit of white nationalists who've gained so much recent attention. By the time he was in his late teens, Derek was already hosting his own radio show. He had launched a white nationalist network website for children and had won a local political election in Florida. One white supremacist even called him the leading light of our movement. He was homeschooled through high school, but Derek surprised his family by telling them he wanted to attend Florida's new college, a liberal arts college in Sarasota. His parents were skeptical, given the school's progressive bent, and people in the movement were critical of the choice, warning that the school would change him. But Derek's father told the skeptics, "Look, if anyone is going to be influenced there, it will be them. Soon enough, the whole faculty and student body are going to know who they have in their midst." It's a longer story than I have time to tell here, but I will provide a link to the full account from the Washington Post in my sermon notes. But it turns out that Derek's father was both right and wrong. He was right that the student body would find out who Derek was, but he was mistaken that Derek would be the greater influence in his educational endeavor. That distinction ultimately belonged to one of Derek's classmates, a young man named Matthew Stevenson. Stevenson was an Orthodox Jew, the only Orthodox Jew in New College at the time, and Derek's first friend at the college. Derek's identity as a white nationalist was exposed in an online campus forum while Derek was studying abroad his sophomore year, so that by the time he returned to campus, he was treated as a pariah. But Matthew Stevenson decided to take a chance. He invited Derek to join some other students at his campus apartment one Friday night for a Shabbat dinner. Matthew always drank from a kiddish cup and said the traditional prayers, but most of his guests were Christian, atheist, black, Hispanic, anyone open enough to listen to a few blessings in Hebrew. Now, in the fall of 2011, Matthew invited Derek to join them. It was the only social invitation Derek had received since returning to campus, so he decided to go. The Shabbat meals had sometimes included 8 or 10 students, but this time only a few showed up. "Let's try to treat Derek like anyone else, Matthew remembered instructing his friends. Derek arrived with a bottle of wine. Nobody mentioned white nationalism or the forum out of respect for Matthew. Derek was quiet and polite, and he came back the next week and the next, until after a few months, nobody felt all that threatened, and the Shabbat group grew back to its original size. And that's how it began, the slow but steady transformation of Derek Black. Some members of the Shabbat group gradually began to ask Derek about his views, and occasionally he clarified them in conversations and emails throughout 2011 and 12. He said he didn't believe in violence, didn't believe in the KKK or Nazism or even white supremacy, which he insisted was different from white nationalism. He said his concern was that massive immigration and forced integration was going to result in a white genocide. He said he believed in the rights of all races, just thought they were better off living separately. But over time, even those concerns eroded, in part because of what he was learning in class, but even more, he said, due to what he was learning from his friends, gathered around prayers, sharing a meal together, exploring the mysteries of community one with another. The rigid certitude was giving way, and Derek was changing, reforming, awakening to a new way of understanding the world and his neighbors and himself. And it all began when someone had the courage and the thoughtfulness to reach out across a chasm of difference and invite him to share a sacred meal. A simple act, and yet a profound mystery at work. What a different world we might inhabit, friends, if others were willing to embrace the mystery. Holy mystery, holy possibility. One summer day years ago, I was with our daughter in the backyard of our home in South Carolina. She was just 3 years old at the time and had not yet developed her later aversion to bugs of any kind. And that day she became fascinated by a column of ants that was marching in single file across the back edge of our patio. For a long time, she walked back and forth across that patio, following a single ant until it disappeared into the grass at the other side, and then returning to follow another all the way. And at one point, in a moment forever etched in our family lore, she stopped, she put her hands on her hips, and she said, "Dad, you should see this. This is just amazing." Well, it is amazing, really, how the mystery that often eludes us and is right before us and we don't notice it can startle us at times and stir us into a deep sense of wonder. For even a tiny creature, in Walt Whitman's terms, is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels. And if it's true of an ant, then what about the ever-expansive grace of God? "Dad," she said, "you should see this. This is just amazing." And it was. But I wonder, are we capable of such amazement in our time? Are we still learning from the world and from the scriptures and from the friends and the strangers we meet at table? Are we still willing to reach across lines of difference to try to understand the other and thus risk learning something new about ourselves? Are we open to the new thing that God may be doing today? Or is everything all neatly tied up with no loose ends? Are we too wedded to our assumptions? Too sophisticated for mystery? Well, they're just questions for Reformation Sunday.